Joining me now in studio, Gary Locke, former Commerce Secretary, former Governor of Washington, former Ambassador to China, and current Honorary Co-Chairman of the PASS USMCA Coalition. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
A pleasure to be with you.
I assume Secretary is the senior most title, so that's the one you're going to go with?
Oh, I don't know. Some people say Governor is the higher title, but I'm not into the never understood all the protocols.
I can make the case for governors being sort of cooler because you're elected by a whole state, but I think technically Cabinet Secretary would be above that.
It doesn't matter. Gary's fine.
So, Gary, the PASS USMCA, we should remind everyone USMCA is the name given to the renegotiated NAFTA agreement. What is the PASS USMCA coalition?
Well, it's a broad-based coalition of business and interest groups, business sectors, including biotechnology, black chambers of commerce, agricultural groups, traditional business groups, very much, and trade groups very much supporting this, what I call NAFTA 2.0. It's a major modification, updating of the NAFTA agreement that was passed some 25 years ago. It's a necessary update to take into account the changing nature of our economy in terms of e-commerce, whether it's digital software, music, movies, books, and games, to also just correcting some of the problems that have occurred over the last 25 years.
I should warn you that so USMCA obviously is one of Donald Trump's biggest priorities. Getting through Congress is one of his biggest priorities. Whenever I call it new NAFTA or anything other than USMCA, I take shots on Twitter because it is assumed that by invoking NAFTA, I'm trying to undermine support for USMCA.
Well, I just think that a lot of us here or a lot of people here in the D.C. area, the Beltway, are into these acronyms. And I think most people around
yes.
the country are familiar with NAFTA. So why
that's
not?
My position
so
as well.
So that's why I call it an updating of NAFTA. So I call it NAFTA 2.0.
That's exactly my reasoning as well, yeah. That unless and until USMCA catches on broadly, I'm going to help my readers understand what we're talking about.
Plus, when I think of USMCA, I keep thinking of the song YMCA. So I'm using something else to differentiate.
I keep thinking of the Marines. So let me ask you this. You know, the mood in the country is not especially positive towards trade. It was negative enough in 2016 that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump said that they would tear up the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Under the auspices of negotiating the TPP agreement, the Obama administration renegotiated NAFTA. What can you tell an American voter today who is skeptical of the merits of approving NAFTA 2.0?
Well, Mexico and Canada are our largest trading partners. So much of what we make in America includes parts from Canada. So much of what we produce is sold to Canada and to Mexico. And oftentimes what we make, when we make some of these things and they have components from Mexico or the United States, we then sell these finally assembled items and sell them all around the world. And they have, therefore, U.S. content, Mexican content, Canadian content, and sometimes we're actually selling it back to Mexico or to Canada. So I believe very much in fair trade. If we want to be able to sell our stuff to other countries, we have to be willing to accept stuff that comes from their country. It cannot be just a one-way street. Why would a country accept buying American-made goods if we take the position that we can't buy anything from them, they can't ship anything to us. Plus, we're really looking at the strengths of each other's economies. I mean, there are parts of the world that make things that are not available or grown. They grow things that cannot be grown here in the United States or not produced in the United States, and so we benefit from having that exchange. Other countries like the stuff that we make, whether it's Boeing airplanes or X-ray equipment or MRI machines, and certainly they love our corn and our soybeans and beef and pork and things like that.
And our cheese.
Or our wine or our software. So, but we want to make sure that there's a level playing field. And so if American companies have to abide by all these rules and regulations on the health and safety of their workers or on the ability to form unions or to adhere to environmental policies and regulations, it's not fair to the American company, the American farmer, to the American worker if other countries don't have to follow those same requirements. It means that the apple grown in Chile, for instance, might be automatically cheaper than the Washington apple. And so we need to make sure that trade agreements level the playing field. And that's what NAFTA wanted to do. several years ago in opening up markets. But we've also shown, it's been shown that we need to beef up the NAFTA and have more protections for workers, for the environment, for the ability of workers to organize and to have reduce some of the barriers that these countries have posed or put up against our products, whether it's the dairy industry. Mm-hmm. A lot of discrimination and barriers against U.S. dairy products and agricultural products going into Canada. Even Washington and California wines going into Canada. So this is really trying to level the playing field, but also enable more commerce to flow between our two countries more freely, but also protect American workers and create more American jobs. For instance, in this agreement requires that any automobile sold in the United States will not have an extra tax put on it as long as 75% of the content of that automobile was built in North America. We also don't want all the jobs going to, let's say, Mexico. And so there's a provision in the agreement that says that 45% of the contents of an automobile must have been built in North America with at least $16 an hour in hourly wages. So that's a disincentive for parts companies and the Detroit automakers to have all of the stuff, let's say, built in Mexico.
I'm talking to Gary Locke, former Commerce Secretary, former Governor of Washington, former Ambassador to China, and now current honorary co-chairman of the PASS USMCA Coalition. So let's build on that then, because one of the concerns that I hear from House Democrats has to do with whether Mexico is going to enforce various provisions, including this higher wage. After all, if historically they've competed on a lower wage, they are hurting themselves, right? Or theoretically, notionally hurting themselves if they start paying a higher wage. They lose some of their competitiveness vis-a-vis the United States. Do you think that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the new president of Mexico, is doing all he can to assuage those concerns?
I do know, I've not met him personally, and I have not followed all of his policies personally, but I have talked with several Democrats in the House of Representatives who have traveled to Mexico, who have met with him, who have very, and these are Democrats who very much care about labor standards and mm-hmm. enforceability and making sure that the signatories to the agreement, Canada and Mexico, will follow through with all the requirements of the agreement. And so they've reported some very good conversations and feel that he is committed and they're already moving forward to implement the provisions of the agreement, even though the United States has not yet ratified it. And so they're I think, feeling good. But what's interesting is that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has formed a working committee of members of Congress who are charged with negotiating with the administration these details, kind of like a extra agreement or clarification that will be part of the agreement outlining these extra measures and about enforcement, about labor standards, about the environmental standards and things like that, that will be part of the agreement.
Secretary Locke, I did my master's in Latin American Studies and International Economics about 10 million years ago. And one of the texts that you have to read when you go to CICE, the Johns Hopkins program, is you've got to read a book called Protectionism by an economist named Jagdish Bhagwati. It's very short, very simple, very straightforward. And it makes the compelling case that countries do better with more open trade than they do with protectionism. But the challenge in America since NAFTA has been, yes, the country might make more money. But as even the economists acknowledge, there are sectors that get displaced. There are industries that get hurt. And I guess my question to you is, when we were talking about getting NAFTA online, the Clinton administration talked about, well, we're going to have this training programs and the rest. Those seem to have fallen short. You know, if you're a 50-year-old auto worker, auto parts manufacturer, something like that, why should someone like that support even a retooled NAFTA? And did we make mistakes by not seeking a more robust effort to help workers who were displaced?
I think that that is a valid concern. We as a country have not put enough money into job training and retraining programs in general, especially to deal with the impacts of trade. We have to recognize that America is making things that are highly valued and in great demand all around the world, and 95% of the world's consumers live outside America. So if we want our companies to prosper and therefore creating jobs for American workers, we need to be able to export. We need to sell our stuff all around the world. 75% of all Boeing airplanes are sold to non-American airlines. They're sold to Middle Eastern airlines, Southeast Asian airlines, European airlines, China. China buys 25% of all the Boeing airplanes that are made. And so, again, 75% of all Boeing airplanes are sold to foreign airline carriers. So if we we grow more than we can actually consume in terms of, you know, we grow more on our farms than we can actually consume. So if we want those jobs for the agricultural sector, we have to be able to export. When we were at the Commerce Department, we had this model. The more American companies export, the more they produce. The more they produce, the more workers they need, and that means jobs for the American people. And trade-associated jobs, by and large, pay more than the average job in America. So, and again, like I said before, 95% of the world's consumers live outside America. So it's a market. We make great stuff. They need it. They want it. And it creates jobs if we sell it. But at the same time, we know that if we then have trade and some of our materials and some of our products are made in other countries that we then buy, that's going to hurt some workers, and they're going to lose some of their jobs, or the number of factories will diminish. We need to do a much better job of providing assistance to those dislocated or displaced workers. In fact, we need to be doing that constantly, even if there was no trade. With the advent of self-driving automobiles, with the advent of artificial intelligence, we're going to have a huge dislocation of workers who will be displaced. And they're the maybe, you know, I've been using this report. McKinsey says that by the year 2030, maybe 5 to 10% of the world's workforce will be displaced because of AI. Now, that's not going to affect the people in some of the most developing or undeveloped countries, whether it's Myanmar or places in Southeast Asia or parts of Latin America or Africa. It's going to fall upon the industrialized nations. So let's say it's really more like 8 to 15% in the advanced industrialized nations. But the point is that, like you said, you got the 50-year-old worker. Well, we're talking about today's 40-year-old worker who 10 years from now will be 50 or 55. Do we expect them to go back to college to get retraining? I mean, shouldn't we start preparing now for that dislocation and start maybe looking at partnerships with companies and employers on retraining people, whether it's in healthcare industry, pharmacy, legal department, even delivery of goods and services?
Gary, you've got a perfect resume for this next question. Former Commerce Secretary, former Ambassador to China, former Governor of Washington, which of course relies heavily on international trade for its economy. Let me ask you this. How does USMCA, how does NAFTA 2.0 change the American economic relationship with China?
It doesn't affect it with China, other than if we come up with a higher standards trade agreement, it can actually be a model or a template for future trade agreements and all around the world with other countries, and in fact, ultimately with China. That's why I was a major supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. For all the complaints that environmentalists have and labor groups have and American businesses have about an unfair or unlevel playing field with other countries where they don't have to, and their companies and farmers don't have to abide by as rigorous standards as Americans have to, this would have addressed it. It would have raised the environmental standards, labor standards, intellectual property standards, health and human safety standards in other countries, and it also would have lowered the duties or the taxes and the extra charges imposed on American goods going into those countries. Well, we backed out. We're not part of the TPP, but Canada is, and many other countries are.
Well, that's why I was asking, because that relationship is complicated, right?
So now Canada can sell their products, let's say, to Vietnam with no or very low duties, But the American product going to Vietnam has to pay that higher duty or cost. So which is cheaper for the consumer in Vietnam? The Canadian good, not the American good. So we really lost out on an opportunity. But China was also very wary of the TPP mm-hmm. because they felt that this would create a new standard of trade agreements in the future. And they would be left out, and they would be left out. And so in some ways, they were hoping that TPP would not come to pass. But America pulled out, and all the other countries went ahead.
I can't let you go. I've only got 2.5 minutes or so with you. I can't let you go without asking some foreign policy nerd questions here. My sources who've served in Moscow say that the Russian government carries out a sustained low-boil campaign of harassment against diplomats. They will rearrange the furniture in some diplomats' houses. They will follow them around. They'll follow their kids to school. Is there anything akin to that when you serve in Beijing?
Well, we know anytime we travel to some of these countries, whether it's Russia or China, that we don't take our electronic devices with us. They're monitored. They're swept, basically, checked out before we leave. And then they're checked when we come back. We're basically told, don't bring your laptops if you can. They can be copied in some ways. People might even come into your hotel rooms to rifle through your personal belongings and look for personal information or official documents. So all diplomats, when we're traveling abroad, especially in countries that are not our closest allies, mm-hmm. we have to be very, very, very careful.
When, as former Commerce Secretary and former Ambassador to China, when you hear Donald Trump say that previous administrations should have taken a much harder line on China, what does that evoke for you?
Well, I think that American companies and American diplomats and policymakers have long and have been growing in their frustrations with China's economic, industrial, trade policies. But let me just say that trying to work these out in a concerted fashion with our allies, especially the EU and other major trading partners, whether it's Korea, Japan, or Singapore and elsewhere, is a better way to go than the tariffs. I mean, yes, the administration is tackling some of these long-standing, long-festering issues, and they've been getting worse more recently, coming to a head. But imposing tariffs, these across-the-board tariffs, on virtually all Chinese goods coming in the United States, I think in a trade war, there are no winners, only losers, and the losers are the American consumer and American companies. First of all, even the New York Fed and various business organizations have said that the average American household is paying an extra $1,000 per year because of the tariffs already put in place, not counting the tariffs that the president is proposing to tack on come Christmas time. He's put tariffs on goods coming from Europe and many other countries. And so it's costing the American consumer. At the same time, China doesn't have to buy American soybeans. China does not have to buy the Boeing airplane. They can buy Airbus. They can get the soybeans from Brazil.
Right.
They don't have to buy the GE MRI machine or X-ray machine. They can buy from Germany. So they have, in some ways, more choices or ability to substitute for the American goods that are now subject to Chinese tariffs going into China, whereas virtually all the shoes that we buy and a lot of the clothes that we buy and the microwave ovens that we buy and the toys and the sporting goods and everything else is made in China. So we're paying that huge tax on these goods when they land at the docks, headed for American retail stores or American companies.
Last one before I set you free, Gary. Talking to Gary Locke, former Commerce Secretary, former Governor of Washington, former Ambassador to China, and current honorary co-chairman of the PASS USMCA Coalition. And that is a number of American and other countries' companies, right down to the NBA, have taken steps to mollify the Chinese. Hotel companies not listing Taiwan as a separate destination, airlines doing the same. I guess I just want your thoughts. As you watch all these different companies bend over backwards to accommodate the Chinese and you see anger in Congress about that accommodation, is there some solution here or is this just the private sector at work?
Well, that is the choice of the private sector. I mean, if they want to do business in China, they have to understand what the politics are. That's their choice. But I also applaud folks for standing up and voicing, you know, exercising their freedom of speech and making their comments. And that is, I think that's one of the tensions that we face. America is a democratic society where we value free speech and the ability to offer your opinions. Just as, you know, foreign companies doing business here in the United States have to follow kind of our culture and follow our laws and our customs and our sensitivities, it's a two-way street. You cannot expect companies from Brazil or, you know, the Middle East or Germany or China or Korea or India to follow our customs and our way of doing things and respect our customs and traditions, but say that U.S. companies do not. I mean, certainly they're making that own decision, and some are standing up and saying, "Okay, we're not going to do business, and we're not going to knuckle under to some of the demands by the Chinese government. We recognize the consequences, and we're willing to live with those consequences." So that's really all these decisions have to be made by the individual corporations, companies, their leaders, their shareholders, their stockholders, and basically also their employees. They have to understand what the ramifications are, and so I hope that it's a collective decision, but one that's done thoughtfully. I also am very proud of some of the individuals and companies who have taken a more principled stand.
All right. He's the honorary co-chairman of the PASS USMCA Coalition, Gary Locke. Gary, thank you very, very much for coming in.
My pleasure.